culture, our name and identity. Lynch, rape, tortured and murdered. Oh, what a brutality. But we shall overcome one day. Atrocities of slavery. Hey, African kings and queens, and young ones in between. We're shining through this darkness. Shall love is all I bring. Hey, African kings and queens, and young ones in between. We're living through our stories. Just let your light be seen.
It is Thursday morning, October 15th, 2020, and you are listening to Fight the Empire. And now here is your host coming up, Pear.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire coming to you on KBOO, your radio station. And it is your station. You pay for it, and it makes your voice heard out in the world. And we need your support. We depend on your support. We depend on your coming to this, being part of the station process, part of the radio process that brings your voice out on the air. On with the show. President Trump picked up another endorsement recently. This one came from the Taliban, and the Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahideen told CBS News, "We believe that Trump is going to win the upcoming election because he has proved himself a politician who accomplished all the major promises he made to the American people. Although he might have missed some small things, so it is possible that the U.S. people who experienced deceptions in the past will once again trust Trump for his decisive actions." Mujahideen added, "We think the majority of the American population is tired of instability, blah, 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 blah." Anyway, he goes on to talk about Biden chanting unrealistic slogans. Some other groups, which are smaller in size but are involved in the military business, including weapons manufacturing companies, owners, and other businesses who somehow get the benefit of war extension, they might be against Trump and support Biden, but their numbers among voters is low. In other words, he's saying we support Trump because he is supporting us. Another senior Taliban leader told CBS News, "We hope he will win the election and wind up the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan." So there are talks going on between the U.S. and the Taliban about ending this. How long has the war been going on? 19 years. But the Trump campaign, they reject the Taliban support, so they say. Campaign spokesman Tim Murtaugh said Saturday they reject the Taliban support. The Taliban should know that the president will always protect American interests by any means necessary. Well, a lot of people might think that American interests are best served by getting out of this seemingly never-ending war. The Trump administration signed a pact with the Taliban in February in which the U.S. and its allies set a timetable for troops to withdraw. The timetable deadline is spring of 2021, not too far from now. The pact requires the Taliban to break from al-Qaeda and negotiate a power-sharing deal with Afghan government rivals. So on the face of it, this seems like a worthwhile goal. It's a it seems to be a good idea, whatever you think of the people involved. More on that later. It's interesting that Russia also seems to be for Trump. If you recall, Trump once said that getting along with Russia is a good idea, which it is, if you can do it. Russia apparently later had its doubts about Trump. They thought he was it'd be great to make make some kind of arrangement or deal with him, but they felt that he was unreliable. And but before one opposes Trump, because of those endorsements, consider that China apparently favors Joe Biden. And the reason for that are all the threats that President Trump has made against China. So sort of the increasing bad feelings between Trump and China. And so being this posture of anger towards China seems to me to be a bad idea. And of course, the conclusion from all this is that we should judge ideas on their merits. Bad people sometimes support good ideas. So in my opinion, ending the war in Afghanistan is a very good idea. It was a lousy idea to begin with. Getting along with China, if you can, is a good idea. It's a better idea than threatening war, which China hasn't been entirely wonderful in this area either. But it seems to me that tensions need to be calmed down between the U.S. and China. Well, when you talk about these countries expressing their feelings, some might call that interference. Others might just say they are expressing a preference. This is something that nations do. What is standard practice in this area? Nations, they speak out on their behalf. They talk about other nations and other people, and it's kind of a very gray line between expressing a preference and interference. It would seem that way to me. But I don't know. What is your opinion? Do you think that nations? What is it? Interference when one nation speaks out for or against something another nation does? This is your radio station. What is your opinion? The number to call is 503 231-8187. It's very interesting that the sort of bad feelings with Russia, well, they go way, way back, but more recently they go back to 2011. And at that time, Vice President Biden was in Moscow, and he said publicly that he didn't think that Putin should run for president of Russia again. Well, a lot of Russians might feel that that is interfering in their internal politics. Biden might just say he is expressing his opinion. But it shows that this kind of, whatever you want to call it, is sort of a standard practice among national leaders. In 2014, the U.S. helped overthrow an elected president in Ukraine, one named Viktor Yanukovych. I don't know how many of you remember that Victoria Nuland, who was a sort of assistant secretary of state, was in the streets of Kiev passing out cookies to the these people who were leading street protests against Yanukovych, and eventually they forced him out of the out of office. The protests got very violent. People were killed by sort of snipers, very mysterious snipers who seem to kill people on both sides in this conflict. But anyway, after a lot of violence and deaths, Yanukovych left the scene. And you would call that interference, certainly. And so when the U.S. Talks about interference in its affairs, we have to recall the U.S. has been doing this to other countries in the world for quite a while. Since then, Ukraine, Yanukovych left, and it's a new government. I think Ukraine has been through one or two presidents now, and there is a civil war going on in Ukraine, which has been portrayed as kind of Russian interference in Ukraine's affairs. A closer look kind of reveals a kind of strange scene. Ukraine's borders, apparently, as far as I can tell, Ukraine never really had any borders until around 1922. In fact, Ukraine means borderland in Russian and Ukrainian. And so Ukraine has always sort of been stuck between different empires. Russia on one side. At one time there was a Polish-Lithuanian empire that spread into what is now Russia. But anyway, Ukraine never really had borders. When they did get their borders, they were sort of the Ukrainian people who speak Ukrainian language only occupy basically the western half of what is now Ukraine. The eastern half is occupied by Russian-speaking people who have always looked to Russia kind of as their, you know, their brothers and sisters, and how they got stuck in one nation I really don't understand. It seems that like not a very good idea. But so you have Ukraine, which is pretty deeply divided. And when Yanukovych was kicked out, he was elected, and his voters came mainly from the eastern part of Ukraine. So after he fled, this new government took over, and for a while they talked about abolishing Russian as an official language in Ukraine, which understandably alarmed the people in that part of the country. and they began rebelling, and there's been this war going on ever since. It's been a fairly bloody war. We haven't heard too much about it lately. A lot of it has been fought by artillery. Shelling has destroyed parts of some cities, killed a lot of people. And so into this scene, when the U.S. dabbles in this kind of dangerous state of affairs, it's not only interference, it's really very foolhardy. And once the new government took over in Ukraine, the people in eastern Ukraine rebelled, and also the people in Crimea rebelled too, because the people in Crimea consider themselves part of Russia. In fact, Crimea was part of Russia until just as recently as 1954. In fact, Crimea was part of Russia for a couple hundred years. And then in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev kind of gave it, presented it to Ukraine as a gift. Not consulting the people of Ukraine or what they wanted to do. And so the people in Crimea felt rather alarmed at their new government, and so they declared their independence, or they opted, they had an election, and they went back, rejoined Russia. And of course the U.S. has been talking about this as considered interference in I don't know whose state of affairs. So that is sort of the behind the scenes history of what is going on with Crimea. I'd like to know, in a way, what do you think? Do you think this constitutes interference by Russia in our state of affairs, or is it the other way around? Give us a call. The number to call is 503-231-8187. A very interesting article recently I saw. There's a sort of more like domestic politics, sort of. This deals with the kind of the divide between city folks and country folks. There are different ways of thinking, different there are different ideals, different ways of life, and as a fellow, a young professor at the University of California in Berkeley, named Jackson Kernighan, and he came out recently with a statement. He said that rural Americans are, quote, bad people, and they deserve to live uncomfortable lives. And he talked about rural health care. This is one thing. If you live in the outside the cities, you know, which actually I did at one point in my life, living down in Tillamook County, that health care is rather a chancy affair. There are not very many hospitals in the countryside, and there are doctors, but you don't have a whole lot to choose from when you live in the countryside. If you have doctors out there at all, you might consider yourself lucky. But this fellow, Jackson Kernighan, said that rural health care should not be, it should be expensive. In other words, he's saying that people in the countryside don't deserve quality health care, or if they do, they should pay for it themselves. I read this article. It's in, let me find out where it came from. Oh, well, it was on Fox News. Take it for what it's worth, but I assume that Fox News quoted this guy accurately. If you want to look him up, his name is Jackson Kernion, K-E-R-N-I-O-N. So I am assuming he said what they are quoting him as saying. But he, I guess he teaches philosophy at UC Berkeley. I would say some real philosophical issues right there, that saying that people who live in the, if nobody lived in the countryside, I think we'd be in a sad state of affairs. But Kernion seems to believe that that affordable rural health care is the same as saying rural Americans should be subsidized by those who choose a more efficient way of life. And according to Kernion, living in the cities is more, it's a more efficient way of life. It is a sort of the standard notion of progress is that the whole world is becoming more and more urbanized. How long this has been going on now for more than 100 years, and how long it will keep on going is anybody's guess, but I guess some people might think that, well, eventually we will all be living in the cities. Well, in that case, you might ask, who is going to feed all these people living in the cities? I think Kernion needs to think this through, because cities really depend on cheap or reasonably priced energy for their very existence. They kind of draw in their food supplies from the surrounding countrysides, and I suppose the standard notion of progress is that agriculture is getting more and more industrial and mechanized. I suppose the end result of that might actually be big, giant factory farms sort of run by robots, just sort of growing food and sending it into the cities to feed these people who are doing whatever they do. I think this vision of progress is badly flawed. It could be the other way around. Rather than cities becoming sort of becoming the bellwether of progress, I would think that it's possible that cities themselves are becoming obsolete. If you get away from an industrial economy, cities have less of a role to play, and there are some futurologists who believe that the future of the world, of this country, is kind of small, more or less self-sufficient towns where people kind of manage to feed themselves and have a modest amount of infrastructure and and sort of a flourish, an economy that keeps itself going without outside input. Another thing to think about is that with the global warming and the rising oceans, that cities themselves, most of the big cities in the world are located on the coast of various countries. And as sea levels rise, these cities are very, very vulnerable to flooding, and not just periodic flooding when you have storms, which has already happened in, like, New York City, for example, but these cities themselves are vulnerable to flooding without end. In other words, as the ocean levels rise, the the water first. Well, Miami is a great example of that, that this is happening in Miami right now. And it's not just flooding in the streets during storms, that the ocean salt water from the ocean is kind of infiltrating into the water table beneath Miami. It's kind of messing up their drinking water. So with rising oceans, you might say the cities are kind of doubly vulnerable, that they're becoming less necessary for an economy, and they're also becoming a kind of a danger to the people who still choose to remain in these cities. You know, one can foresee a future in which cities are really abandoned because nobody can live in them anymore. And, you know, you can sort of foresee some of the great cities of the world becoming more and more like Venice with canals. And Venice itself is very invulnerable. One thing that these cities do to protect themselves from rising ocean is they talk about building seawalls. I guess Venice has one already, and they tried it out recently. Apparently it worked. It kept major floods from coming into the city. New York is talking about building some kind of a seawall to protect itself from the ocean. I'm not sure exactly where it would go. One proposal that I've seen would build a seawall between, I guess, between Brooklyn and Staten Island, which is sort of the narrowest part of the entrance to New York Harbor. And I suppose this would protect the city on one side of the seawall. Might not do very much for parts of the city outside the seawall. So this is kind of a feature of urban life that people like Jackson Kernighan, the UC instructor, should think about more deeply. But there is this idea that somehow civilization is bound to be more industrial, more urban, kind of that what we have now will continue to increase, that the things that led up to the growth of cities will just continue without any obstruction. This may be a very short-sighted view, but to end this show, I think I'll give some good news. One is that according to one report, global energy consumption could be reduced to a 1960s level, and this would be even with a population three times larger than it was back then. In this report talks about 10 billion people in the year 2050. That's kind of three times what it is now. But at the same time, energy consumption could be reduced to a 1960s level. And this is really very good news. The report did say that that rich people would have to consume less, which I think is a good idea on its face. When you read about the extravagant lifestyles of some of these billionaires and would-be trillionaires, it's kind of obscene the way that, you know, what the resources they gobble up while so much of the world is living on very little. And so, but according to this report, most people would be living well on less energy, and the way they define living well is that the average family, they could have a laptop computer with internet connection, and there would be a phone for everyone in the family, and they could keep their homes heated or cooled to kind of a constant 68-degree temperature. And so that is sort of the basics of of what we consider ordinary living. And according to this report, that this could continue in the future, up to the year 2050, on less energy than we use now. And I would say this is a very cheerful bit of news, and I just hope it comes true. So that's it for Fight the Empire for this installment. Next show is will be November 5th. That'll be after the election, presumably by November 5th. Well, maybe not. That's a big question. Will we know who actually won the election or not? The election is November 3rd, but because of late returns and the late ballot counting and all sorts of shenanigans, and it's hard to tell what will be going on then, but next show is scheduled for November.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
So we'll say farewell, and we will be back on November 5th.